Good evening. The room seemed particularly still tonight as I was bowing in. Which made the creaking of my knees sound even louder to me. Thank you for being here tonight. It's a little awkward to be in the same time spot as major political events. Thank you for setting aside this time and enjoying each other's company. I'd like to speak tonight about the importance of Dharma friendship. And I have a variety of ways to weave this together. We'll see what exactly wants to come out as we go. Partly I'm inspired to talk about Dharma friendship because of the event that occurred over the weekend. That was the All Sangha meeting. We have one of these each year. And each one has a flavor of its own. This one felt particularly warm and friendly to me. And I want to acknowledge the role that board members have in keeping this place going. It's an example of Dharma friendship that is being expressed. When board members attend meetings every month, tending to the property, the money, internal organizational structure, they're doing this so that you have a place to come and experience the Dharma. This is an example of Dharma friendship. And the same is true of all of our little committees that meet. Practice committee, the practice leaders also, that establish the calendar, that fill the roles. The roles themselves are example of Dharma friendship. People have learned how to ring the bells and attend to the teachers and play the drum so that you have a place to come and experience the Dharma. This is truly inspiring, truly supportive. Even the detail of the flowers that kind of secretly appear and disappear when they fade, every detail is tended to in the spirit of Dharma friendship. I'd like to make reference to a book called The First Buddhist Women, and the author is Susan Murcott. And in this book, she talks about the, obviously, the first Buddhist women and their role and the flavor that they established for the early practice years. And she speaks of them by name. And in the early years, the women, I think, especially wrote a death poem, maybe everyone did, and we know the women by their death poems. And this one, whose name is Mita, Mita translates as friend. It has the same root as metta. We chant the Metta Sutta, the Sutra of Loving Kindness, as the same root. So, Mita's poem. Friend, who has left home in trust, take delight in friends. Cultivate good qualities to gain peace. That's her, apparently her final teaching. And scholars, I'm not a scholar, I don't really know. I read what scholars write. Some scholars say that there were two people named Mita. who had slightly different characteristics. And some scholars say that there was one, and all of those characteristics are blended into one person named Mita. But either way, that one or those two wrote another poem that parallels a poem that Kisa Gotami wrote. So, with good friends, even a fool can be wise. Keep good company and wisdom grows. Those who keep good company can be freed from suffering. This parallels something that the Buddha taught apparently right around that same time. And Susan Murcott writes it this way: in light of the importance of friendship, the Buddha devotes an entire discourse to this theme. And here's a part of that discourse. One who says, "I am your friend," but does not take upon herself any task she is capable of doing, is to be recognized as no friend. But she on whom one can rely is truly a friend who cannot be parted from one by others. This capacity to be relied upon is partly what makes friends friends, an environment of trust. So, from the earliest people, these women in particular, up to contemporary times, with two women who are nuns practicing in the Tibetan tradition, had a conversation with each other, and it was published. And part of their conversation reads this way. After the question, "What did the Buddha say about spiritual friendship?" And this is one of them now. Her understanding, in a way, it's an interpretation of the Buddha's teaching. She says, "Knowing that we need support for our practice, the Buddha organized the Sangha as a group of spiritual friends. It's very difficult to sustain the discipline necessary both to keep up the precepts and regular meditation. We usually think of our friends as people with whom we have fun, but friendship in Buddhism is different because it's free of attachment. Its aim is to foster an attitude of long-term well-being among those involved." That's not to say that we shouldn't have fun. And it's a little different in quality, that the intention is the cultivation of well-being and the companionship that lives inside taking care of each other. A little bit later in that same conversation, the other of the two was asked the question, "How do you facilitate this? How does it work in Sangha life?" They're particularly talking about spiritual friendship in spiritual community. And one says, "You have to model it." And the other said, "You have to live it." And the first who said, "You have to model it," speaks it this way. Communities are established so that when new people join, they pick up easily on what to do. They feel it. Everyone has the same precepts, cultivates the same views, and pursues the same goals. We're not just doing our own trip. In some ways, I think this is hard for Westerners because we're so individualistic. You know, we may think we're sitting down for our own benefit. And actually, the one who said you have to live it speaks it this way. We may actually think we're doing our own trip, but actually we're living for the benefit of others, is the implication there. So this wish to support the well-being of others or the well-being of the community, which includes our own activity, is the intent of spiritual friendship. There's a teaching about this. There are many teachings about this. Let's see. I'm going to detour into something I didn't actually expect to say, but I'll speak it because it popped up. I have great affinity and also great dislike for the Lotus Sutra. I'm probably not supposed to say that. I'll tell you why I find it hard to love it all of the time. In the Lotus Sutra, the Buddha is sometimes portrayed as if a deity. And I'm not quite finding my way with that. He's deified, or at least reified. And on the flip side of that, the parables that are in the Lotus Sutra actually sum up the entirety of the Buddha's teaching. So one of the parables in there teaches that each being has the capacity to be Buddha. And we've heard of the practitioner that became known as the Bodhisattva Never Disparaging, who bowed to each one equally, was apparently at first, at least in some translations, called the Bodhisattva Always Disparaged, because people disdained him for saying, "You will be Buddha someday." Apparently at the time, only the Buddha was supposed to be the one who could say, who predict who could be Buddha. So the other people disparaged him for being presumptuous, I guess we would say, that he shouldn't be saying, "You'll be Buddha," but bowed to each other speaking, "You will be Buddha someday." And thus, always disparaged turned into the Bodhisattva Never Disparaging. It's a beautiful teaching in and of itself. But this, in the Lotus Sutra, you will always eventually find your way to be Buddha. And if we believe anything that Dogen many centuries later said about being time, and kind of the timelessness of time, if one is going to be Buddha, it's actually so that one is already Buddha. There's no obstacle. So, that said, the sutra that I actually wanted to talk about is called Magaya Sutra. And it's based on, apparently based on a story that after Ananda had, you've probably heard this many times, Ananda had posed an inquiry to the Buddha saying, something like, "I'm beginning to wonder whether having good friends isn't half the holy life." Something like that. As things get translated, it's always a little strange, but isn't having good Dharma friends half the holy life? And the Buddha's response, "No, no, Ananda." And you wouldn't expect a no about that, right? He said, "No. Having good Dharma friends is the whole of holy life." So soon thereafter, this teaching occurred. Magaya is someone who wanted to practice meditation alone. There's nothing wrong with practicing meditation alone. But Magaya found himself anything but peaceful. And was his mind is described as snarled. That's pretty visceral description. Confused thoughts. And the conjecture is that the confused thoughts and the snarl was based on being a little bit too self-absorbed. So the Buddha's teaching that evolved from that conversation is something like this. There are five things that induce the release of heart. That's an interesting turn of phrase, that induce the release of the heart. So undoing the snarl is another way to talk about it. Or that induces lasting peace. Here are the five things. Would you like to know them? I hope so. First, lovely intimacy with good friends. Second, virtuous conduct. Third, frequent conversation that inspires and encourages practice. Fourth, diligence, energy, enthusiasm for the good. None of these are a surprise. You know, we've heard them all in other lists, right? They come up as the paramitas. They come up in a variety of ways. And fifth, the insight into impermanence. All of these five things induce the release of the heart, or the allow the inner landscape to become unconstricted is another way to say that. Then, for Magaya's benefit, the Buddha goes through the list, associating the last four all with the first one. Let's see if I can do that out loud for you so that you get a sense of what the Buddha was teaching. So, where there is friendship, there is frequent conversation that inspires and encourages practice. Where there is friendship, there is enthusiasm for the good, or vigor. Where there is friendship, there is insight into impermanence. Each one of them gets referred back to where there is friendship. Where there is friendship, there is virtuous conduct. So, the importance of this is that the friendship part is underlined. We're not in this for ourselves alone. You know, the visual of the room is deceiving in some ways, each one in their own little space, their own little cushion that is set aside from each other cushion. So we're each one in our own little bubble, and it's deceptive because we're not actually alone. And this is true throughout space and time. I have the experience somewhat frequently of the ancients' teachings, because we recite them so often, the ancients' teachings kind of rise up like, you know how a cartoon character might show a thought bubble? It's kind of like a thought bubble, but it's not a thought. It's a little gestalt that pops. So the teachings of the ancients come through these recitations and chants that we do repeatedly. And many of them are sutras that the Buddha himself taught, and many of them are what we would call enlightenment poems. The way people in their place, in their time, in their personal set of conditions expressed what they began to see. It's important that we recognize that those teachings are those people in their place at that time. And it's not unlike the board members in current time showing up to take care of this place, or people who brush and clean the cushions each morning taking care of this place. These people of ancient times took the time to write down their teaching so that you could benefit from it. You know, some unknown person in the future benefiting from their teaching. They were talking to their students, probably, mostly. But writing it down, that's the amazing part of written language. It's a way of having conversation over space and time. There's a very, very contemporary teacher whose words are this way. Sylvia Bornstein, maybe you've heard of her. And she has been speaking about the value of spiritual friendship. So she says this: perhaps that's the clue about the happiness inherent in caring connections. So she's equating caring connections in spiritual community as a resource. The frightened I who struggles is replaced by the we who do this difficult life together, looking after one another, holding hands. Here's the value of spiritual friendship. It's not now a frightened I who's alone. It is perhaps a frightened I in companionship with other frightened eyes who are figuring out this way together. Another thing that came by me this week seems related. A phrase that Dogen spoke or wrote that is pronounced this way: Waga Shin Kore Dojo. And is translated as something like this, that Roshi Joan Halifax in Santa Fe, is that right? Santa Fe, at Upaya, taught something about this. It's translated some way like this: one's own heart, this is the practice hall. And I want to dissect the phrase just a little bit. I studied it some. There's a great website if you get interested in the Japanese syllables. There's a great website called jisho.org. You can go in and type the syllables and find the characters and find the multiple translation of each character, what their roots are. And their roots often have multiple meanings. In this case, the wa-ga part, the wa is one's own. It's the same wa that's on our donation box. That is, that one translates as, just yourself is quite enough. And put your whole self in that donation box. That's enough.
Which one is it? Mm-hmm. Do you know which one is the wa?
Top right.
Top right.
Mm-hmm. Wa. And there's a Catherine story that goes with that, but I don't want to go there right now. So the wa-ga, and the ga part of wa-ga is, it's just a grammatical syllable that makes the wa a subject of a sentence. Yeah, nothing other than that. So wa-ga, shin, and we've seen shin many times. It is mind and heart that appears. It's a four-stroke character that appears in almost everything we do. So one's own mind and heart, not just one's own mind, but one's own mind and heart. And then the kore is translates as this person. It also translates as this place. It also translates as this moment. So all embedded into kore, is this person, this place, this moment. And then the last part of the phrase, dojo, we've heard it like in a place where you could practice martial arts, a dojo. It's considered this as well, a practice place. The do is way, as in the pronunciation Dao or Tao. Mm-hmm. You've heard that many times. So that's the do part, and the jo is place. So one's own mind and heart, this person, this place, this now, certainly is a practice place. That's a very profound teaching, because we can't expect it to be somewhere else. We can't expect it to be in some other time. Even though those other times inspire us, what exactly are we bringing to this moment? I'm suggesting that this very act of engaging in spiritual companionship is what opens the heart to the precise moment that is occurring. Mm-hmm. And it's not exotic. I feel embarrassed sometimes to be wearing clothes that are not of my culture. You know, because this whole practice is not exotic. It's very ordinary. And I have a sense that you would probably listen to me differently if I sat here in jeans and a t-shirt. So I put on the clothes to help you pay attention for no other reason. The last thing I'll bring forward is out of Dogen, who's got a teaching called Dotoku. And the very end of Dotoku is this way. Now, this is what teachers do. Teachers recall teachers who came before them and dialogues that they may have had with teachers in their contemporaries. So Dogen is recalling Seppo testing the hut master, and they had just had an exchange about the black dragon's pearl, that black dragon's pearl falls easily into the hands of one who knows how to receive it. So that Dogen is making reference to that conversation. And now Dotoku conclusion. So in conclusion, there are ways for good friends in the expression of the truth to pay unexpected visits. And between friends who are unable to say anything, although they do not expect recognition, the means are already present for their selves to be known. When there is learning in practice of knowing the self, there is the reality of expressing the truth.
One more time. Mm-hmm.
There are ways for good friends in the expression of the truth to pay unexpected visits. Between friends who are unable to say anything, although they do not expect recognition, the means are already present for their selves to be known. When there is learning in practice of knowing the self, there is the reality of expressing the truth. Mm-hmm. We don't expect to be fully recognized by each other. And yet, even when I think I'm hidden, you see me. And even when you think you are hidden, I see you. This is the gift of the vulnerability of spiritual friendship. We get past what is expressible in words and find that we can just be in this open-hearted, unconstrained way. Therefore, even if momentary, we're freed from our suffering because all of a sudden connection exists. And then we get constrained again, suffering returns, and then, oh yeah, something releases. This is the breathing in and breathing out of Dharma friendship. I'm going to make an experiment. This is based on something that the practice committee discussed and said we could try out. Here's the experiment. I'll take a question or two, not many. Then we'll have announcements and break for tea. Those who wish to go outside and have tea, converse with each other, perfect. And those who would like to bring their tea back in, I'll be at this end of the room if you'd like to continue the conversation. So this is a way of not keeping a captive audience for those who are ready to bounce up and go have cookies, you know, but for continuing the conversation, those who might like to continue the conversation. That's the first part of the experiment. Here's the second part of the experiment. In a moment, we're going to do the vows. Beings are numberless, I vow, to save them and so on. I will ask us to de-emphasize the I and strongly emphasize the vow. Usually it sounds like this. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Pretty strong on the I. I'm going to ask us to do this. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Feel what it feels like to de-emphasize I, even if momentarily. Yes?
I often do when just vowing,
take
out the I.
Yes.
This
is something that Blanche taught.
Yeah.
I don't know if you knew that.
No, I didn't. But yeah. I just felt after a while, it was kind of like, yeah, why the I so much? It's all about the
great question. Who is that I who's vowing? Great question. So, two experiments after two questions. Anything, questions or comments? What's on your mind? Uh-oh, have I scared you from asking a question? That's fine. Rick, please.
Just, of course, in the original Chinese or Japanese, there's no pronoun.
Say again?
In the original Chinese or Japanese, there's no pronoun.
So there wouldn't be an I there at all. Yeah. Good. Thank you. Yes?
Not here. Mara. But Samaya is a Sanskrit vowel. Does that sound right? But the vowel is held in the heart.
Yes. I followed you. Yes. Both held and expressed. Isn't that one of the interesting tensions that we hold? Both in and out at the same time. All right. I'm going to ask you to hold that, Joyce. I'm going to see if I can manage this experiment. That was two comments. Forgive me for being rigid. We will have... let me think about it. We will close. We'll do the vows. We'll have announcements. We'll leave. Those who would wish to bring their tea back in, I'll be back at this end of the room to converse. And I would love to hear your question or comment at that time. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings